Houston. Fifth Ward Community Redevelopment Corporation.
Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch, and it's our way of saying it's Thursday, 10 p.m., and friends, it's time for So What's Your Story? We're the only radio program in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored 90.1 KPFT Houston. I'm Warren Holloman. Tonight I'll be your host. Joining me to work the boards is our erstwhile intern, Nicole Grady. Hi, Nicole. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
I'm great. I'm guessing you're in the middle of exam period right now?
I am at the very end, thank God.
Oh, great. And that honors average is still...
That honors average, is it has to be 3.5 or higher. It's going strong.
Hang in there. Well, we couldn't do the show without Nicole, that's for sure, but nor could we do it without our other members of our team, Hank Rubicek, Greg Aldell, Mary Edgerton, and Alondra Mejia. We think we're the best team on the radio, but we know we have the most fun. The reason we do this show is because we believe every day of every life is a story worth telling, and we believe that every good story has the power to infuse our lives with meaning. Tonight's storytelling guest has made a career out of teaching stories to college students and helping them discover the meaning of those stories for their lives. Dr. William Monroe has spent the last 30 years of his life as a professor of English at the University of Houston, and for the last decade, he's been the dean of the Honors College. He's the author of the book Power to Hurt, The Virtues of Alienation. Bill, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you, Warren. It's a pleasure to be here tonight.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you again. Would you tell our listeners about the Honors College?
Sure, absolutely. I have to admit I have a biased perspective, but for me, the Honors College is one of the most important intellectual hubs in the city. The college is made up of students and faculty from virtually every discipline, all of them highly talented and highly motivated. It's really a kind of best of both worlds situation, an outstanding small college right in the middle of a big metropolitan public university in this great city of Houston.
Well, I know that up close and personal because I had the pleasure of teaching there for a couple of years with you, and that was just a wonderful time of my life. I used to say the Honors College is Houston's best kept secret, but based on your growth the last few years, I'm guessing it's no longer a secret.
Well, it's true. The college has grown a great deal in terms of student enrollment. The numbers have doubled in the past 6 to 8 years. We've got well over 2,000 active students now in the college. And they're majoring in everything from architecture and engineering and business to the humanities, philosophy, English, classics, history. So it's really a fun place to be and to work.
Great. Now, English teachers generally teach stories, but I hear you also like to collect them, and a special type of story, stories that help shape human character. Define for our listeners what you mean by character.
So the way that I'm using the word character is a kind of collection or a constellation might be a better word of the beliefs, values, desires, and images. I recently sort of added images that make up a person. Mm-hmm. And for me, character is not necessarily a positive term, but it does indicate some kind of consistency over time. So there needs to be some duration for someone to have a character, good, bad, or whatever. And so I think that idea of time or duration is one way to connect character directly with story.
Yeah. Great. Well, now go ahead and tell us your first story.
So I'd come back to the University of Houston, come back home, really, and was working with Ted Estes in what was then the University Honors Program. And we were both, if I might say so, ahead of the curve a little bit in thinking about the value of narrative in the field of English studies. At that particular time, and I'm talking about the mid to the late 80s, theory was the most important concept. And narrative was sort of ignored or even frowned upon. It was definitely out of fashion. Well, Ted and I were outliers, and we had fortunately found each other and offered each other support in what you might think of as a kind of professional catacombs that we were hiding in. And we were relatively safe there to talk and tell stories. So we were at a conference together in Salt Lake City, and I walked over from the conference hotel to the downtown library, probably to do some paper grading or something. And I saw a big poster as I walked into the library with, I believe, Felicia Rashad and her favorite book. I don't remember what the book was, but the tagline was something like, "Books make a difference."
Wow.
And I thought, well, that's interesting. I knew who Felicia Rashad was, of course. In fact, I think I recently discovered that she was a Houstonian.
Yes. Felicia Allen Rashad and her sister Debbie Allen. Their father was a dentist in the Third Ward, a very big contributor to the community in a million ways. And they grew up right near the University of Houston.
Okay, well, that's an extra cool thing about this. There were some other posters with several other famous people. They were also holding books that had made a difference to them. And I just had a kind of eureka moment. And I thought, what if I could interview people who were high achieving, who were accomplished, compassionate, and ask them what books had made a difference to them, and try to find out why they thought those books had made a difference, something more than just sort of holding them in a photograph. So when I got back to Houston, I found out about a summer research opportunity, and I put together a little proposal called Stories and the Shaping of Character. So the first thing I had to do with the project, it did get approved, was to go to a committee on the protection of human subjects.
Storytellers.
Right. And, you know, God forbid that you should ask someone about what stories had made a difference to them without going through the proper channels. So I had to send them a rather formal letter, get a release, have them write back an indication that they were willing to talk to me. And that could have put up a lot of impediments for a lot of people. But there were still a goodly number of them that responded, and I was able to interview some. So, you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask them was what kinds of stories had contributed to who they were, to their characters. You know, what did they turn to? What did they return to when they lost their bearings and needed to recalibrate? Originally, I had hopes that they would give me the titles of actual books, mm-hmm. maybe books that I was teaching in my class and might have some input on, you know, what my syllabus might look like. But what I found is that most of the people weren't telling me about stories that had made a difference to them, but they wanted to tell stories of their own.
Right.
And so this was kind of a breakthrough for me. I found out that most people are storytellers, but relatively few are literary critics. And that's probably a good thing.
Yeah. And this was years before stories were really cool, I guess, and out in popular culture.
Well, absolutely. I had to discover by an empirical approach, now I've learned to call it ethnography, that the books that I'd been reading and teaching were not the ones that people were referring to when they said this or that story made a made a difference to me, or this story played a big part in shaping my character. there were some real differences between the stories that they were telling me and what I had expected to hear.
Right, right.
So one of those differences is sort of, I think, if we think about oral storytelling versus literary storytelling. And one of the things I've thought about in this context is how relatively few people in the history of the world have actually been readers and writers. Mm-hmm. But virtually everyone has been a storyteller, a hearer and teller of stories. So this should give us a clue to something in English studies.
Yeah. Yeah. So the curriculum is always the written word, and there's probably hundreds of thousands of years of stories before writing ever took place.
Absolutely, and it's ongoing. I mean, even a small percentage of the people living right now are readers and writers.
Yeah.
So this emphasis on orality, I think, is an important thing that we often miss.
Right. What would you like our listeners to take from this sort of epiphany that you had as an English professor who's been through years of graduate school learning how to tear stories up, not stories, tear written literature apart, analyze it to death, and now you've come full circle back to sort of the roots of stories? What would you like our listeners to learn, take from that?
Well, I think I'd like people to be a little bit more conscious, a little bit more self-aware about how narratives are shaping all of us, the stories that we tell and hear. I'd like folks to consider that Vonnegut, Kurt Vonnegut, is probably right when he says, we are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be. Mm-hmm. To me, that means we are the stories we tell. So let's tell some good ones, as Wayne Booth says, in some of the better genres.
Yeah. Now, I know some of the stories that you teach in your freshman English course in the Honors College are stories that probably began as in orality, like the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Old Testament, the Bible.
Absolutely, yes. The Homeric epics we consider to be sung originally, and eventually they were written down, and we have them, and that's why we have them. But they certainly originated in an oral tradition. Mm-hmm. Yet they're extremely, extremely complex, and they'll support an infinite amount of analysis. So I think that... I think that that's absolutely true. I think there was a period of time, and I'll go back to the 80s and maybe the 90s, 70s also, where there was a sense that the oral tradition had shot its bolt, that it was done. Mm-hmm. And I've lived long enough now, we were visiting earlier, to think that maybe it's come back. And that's being recognized. And the show like this is, in fact, part of that.
I remember when you started this project, because that's when I was at U of H. And I never told you, but about 5 years ago, I sat down and made a list of all the stories that I either grew up hearing from my parents or their brothers and sisters, or the, you know, elders in the community, and also the stories from my own life that had been powerful. And then I started listing sort of the things I learned from those stories or how they may have related to the person I became. And it was quite an exercise in self-revelation.
I'm sure it was. I have to confess, I haven't had the courage to actually do that myself. It's it's easier to do it on other people.
Yeah, the list got quite long. I even taught a workshop on it to a group of family therapists and had them do the same exercise.
Wow.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, I'm Warren Hollum, and my guest tonight is Bill Monroe. You're listening to So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. If you're down in Galveston, you can catch us at 89.5. And if you're anywhere in the solar system, you can catch us online at www.kpft.org. Bill has another story for us, but first I want to check back in with Nicole. So She can tell you about the Houston Storytellers Guild, The Moth, next week's show, good stuff like that.
Well, thank you very much, Warren. Now, you know our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, is one of the most active local storytelling organizations in the United States, as well as the Houston area. Now, they do meet at the fourth Tuesday night of every month at 1805 West Alabama, right next to the Chocolates.
The chocolate bar,
not a factory. I'm sorry. Chocolate factory is R. Kelly. We're not talking about R. Kelly. We're talking about the factory. But, you know, this month in December, because of the holiday season, they will not be meeting, but they will pick back up again in January. So, meanwhile, you can check out their website at www.HoustonStorytellers.org. And while you're there, you can also go to So What's Your Story under the radio programs and listen to all of our old shows.
Cool. And then there's The Moth. Next Houston Moth Story Slam is next week. That's Tuesday, December 13th, 7:30, Warehouse Live, as always. The theme for December is risk. If you've ever thought about coming to The Moth and telling a story, we encourage you to take a risk. You'll fit right in. Also, Hank, Greg, Mary, and I often tell stories there, so if you come, please say hi to us. We'd love to meet you. We usually sit up front on the right side of the room.
Well, thank you for that tidbit. And as for our show, next week, Hank is hosting his guest, Miss Sherita Galvez. Now, Sherita is a Dr. Seuss specialist, and she'll tell Dr. Seuss stories.
As a child, I loved Dr. Seuss. I'm looking forward to that. I think that's the reason I decided to have kids. I wanted an excuse to read those stories again. I think I memorized Green Eggs and Ham. I can't wait. It'll be good.
Have you ever had Green Eggs and Ham?
I think one time.
One time?
I think I made them for the kids.
Yeah. Wow.
Every good parent does that.
Well, that's awesome. I too, love Dr. Seuss, and I have read Horton Hears a Who about a who many times.
And tell us about the Facebook page.
Well, yes. I would like to remind all of us, our listeners, about our Facebook page. It's So What's Your Story. There you can friend us, like us. Make sure you leave your comments. You can check out who's coming on our show. You can also watch videos of the show. And make sure we want your feedback, guys. You also can subscribe to our new YouTube channel, So What's Your Story, KPFT 90.1. We would love to see you there.
It's been lots of fun. Kudos to Nicole for putting that together.
Thank you.
Now back to our guest. Bill, I was fascinated by your project of collecting stories and by the response from many of those you contacted. Now, I understand that one of the people you contacted, you were brave. You contacted the Dr. Denton Cooley, and with his recent death, just I think 2.5 weeks ago, your upcoming story is going to be especially timely. But first, remind us of some of the accomplishments of this giant of medicine.
Well, yes, I did contact Dr. Cooley, and he did respond to me. He was very kind to do so. I had heard about Denton Cooley. His name was spoken in reverential terms around my house growing up. I think in part because my parents had gone to high school with him at the old San Jacinto High School over on Caroline Street, where Houston Community College Central Campus is now. Of course, he was a legendary native Houstonian, one of the greatest figures the city has ever produced. He's known for implanting the first artificial heart, which was, I think, in 1968, which is when the story takes place. And also for his incredible skills as a cardiac surgeon. I think I read somewhere that he still holds the record for performing the most heart transplants.
Wow.
But a lot of people didn't know until his obituary came out that he was also a high-achieving person in virtually every realm. He was a star basketball player in high school. He went on to start for the University of Texas.
Right.
He graduated Phi Beta Kappa with a degree in zoology. He went on to medical school at Johns Hopkins. He served in World War II. He founded the Texas Heart Institute at St. Luke's, and so on and so on. So he was an obvious choice for my project, someone with character. I just had to get his attention.
And I just think it's absolutely amazing that a man as busy as he was took the time to actually write you a story, I mean, an original story, and on all of all themes on the topic of basically what we today call work-life balance.
Well, exactly. And it's interesting because when he did respond, it was very thoughtful and kind, but he didn't follow my instructions.
Good luck with that.
I'm right. I think that was a problem with Dr. DeBakey, too. This is what he wrote. Dear Dr. Monroe, enclosed is the story you requested for your research project. It recounts an incident that affected me deeply. I hope the story is acceptable for your project. Yours sincerely.
Denton Cooley, and I'm just hoping we don't spill coffee on that.
There we go. So I'll put that off to the side. But, what happened was when he sent me the story, again, this was part of my re-education about the project. It was kind of forced a kind of disruptive innovation, if you will, for me to re-examine my project.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, so I had asked him which stories had contributed to the shaping of his character, and what he turned around and sent me was an original story of his own. And again, it helped me realize that probably telling stories to each other and to ourselves is a way of processing things and narrativizing the events that happen to us is universal and something that I should pay more attention to.
Right. Well, share his story with us.
Okay, sure.
It's called an Acapulco experience.
Exactly. An Acapulco experience. Denton A. Cooley, M.D. It was the summer of 1968, some 8 months after Christian Barnard had done his historic cardiac transplantation in Cape Town, South Africa. We had also become involved with cardiac transplantation at the Texas Heart Institute, and by August had performed 6 successful transplants, more than any other group. It was time for my annual summer vacation with my 5 daughters, who ranged in age from 9 to 18 years. We had been invited by Carlos Truitt, the owner of Las Brisas in Acapulco, to be his guest for a 2 weeks holiday. At Las Brisas, we stayed at a special house that Carlos had built for his children. The house, which was located at the top of the mountain, had a private pool and all the amenities. I had just put on a bathing suit to prepare for a swim when the telephone rang. We had a 12-year-old heart recipient back in Houston who was dying from a viral infection of the heart. An adolescent donor was available, who had suffered a serious head injury while riding a motorcycle. There was no alternative but to return to Houston immediately, which I did. The operation, which was performed immediately upon my arrival, was a success. I was touched both by the emotion expressed by the recipient's mother and also by the sadness of the donor's parents. Within 48 hours, I had returned to Acapulco to rejoin the family. The first full day at Las Brisas was a Saturday, and we attended the bullfight in the local arena. A young toreador, making his professional debut, appeared to fight the bull. The 16-year-old son of a famous Mexican matador, he was a handsome sight in his suit of lights. It was a thrill to all of my daughters when he saluted our group. He performed beautifully and was awarded the ears of the bull, one of which was thrown to my daughter Helen. The next day at La Perla, the large swimming pool near the sea, the matador suddenly appeared. Helen, the 9-year-old, was on the 10-foot high dive getting ready to plunge into the pool when someone exclaimed, "Manuelito!" Helen turned abruptly and lost her footing. She fell to the rocks below, making a sound like a sack of wet flour. I ran to her side. She was unconscious and bleeding from a scalp laceration. We loaded her into a Jeep and left for the downtown municipal hospital, the only facility available on Sunday afternoon. At the hospital, I tried to identify myself as a surgeon, but my wet bathing suit and bare feet were not very convincing. Fortunately, a nurse was reading Life magazine, which happened to have my photograph on the cover, a result of my performing a heart transplant operation. The nurse looked at me in disbelief. Nevertheless, this coincidence made it possible for me to treat Helen's scalp wound and to order the necessary x-rays. The films revealed a skull fracture of little significance. Helen had by then regained consciousness and seemed to be well. We returned to our house in Las Brisas. During the evening, the family gathered and thought deeply about little Helen. A feeling of closeness ensued from this emotional experience, a new feeling that I had not felt previously with my family. Mother and daughters were weepy, but in control. There was a personal feeling of helplessness on my part, although the family looked to me for strength. I searched my conscience about the recent events. What if Helen had suffered an irreversible brain injury that would have made her a potential candidate for organ donation? Would I have had the courage to make that decision for her and for the family? The entire episode brought our family closer together and reinforced those ties that sometimes become rather tenuous. As Thomas Jefferson said, "The happiest moments of my life have been the few which I have passed at home within the bosom of my family." For that time, a meaningful experience had unified us in a posture of common concern, purpose, and mutual affection.
Wow. You have quite a gem there. That's incredible. What are you going to do with that story?
Well, you know, I don't know. I have not read this story in 30 years. And when Dr. Cooley passed away, I went into my various sorts of sites where things are stored away and, to my amazement, was able to come upon it.
Yeah.
But it's more moving now, I suppose, at 30 years distance than it was even at the time.
It's an incredible story, and I wish we had the time to have you put on your English professor hat and kind of break it down, because it's got all the elements of a great story. But we are just about out of time, and I want to thank you, Bill, for joining us tonight, for sharing with us your love of stories, whether you're reading them, analyzing them, teaching them, or collecting them. And I want to thank you for encouraging heart transplant surgeons, maybe the most famous surgeons in the world, to write their stories too. Because whether you're world famous or just an everyday Joe, every day of every life, as we say here, is a story worth telling. So thanks, Bill, for being on the show tonight.
It's been a pleasure, Warren. Thank you for having
me.
And
I hope we can get you back sometime to tell some more of these stories.
I would love to come.
Scooter is next with The Inner Side. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 10 p.m. for So, What's Your Story? And ease into the weekend right. You keep loving a great story, and we'll keep bringing them to you. Be good to each other. Till next week, Bill, Nicole, Alondra, Mary, Greg, Hank, and I remind you that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
What does it look like when leaders from different faiths work together for social change? See for yourself at 7 p.m. on Thursday, December 15th at the Rothko Chapel. The nonprofit dedicated to social justice is hosting Houston's Faith Elders. Social justice, social change in the presence of the divine. This conversation with Rabbi Samuel Karf, Reverend William Lawson, and Archbishop Joseph Fiorenzo will be moderated by award-winning journalist Melanie Lawson. The three professional clergy have worked together on social justice issues around Houston for decades. The event will offer a window into their interfaith work and a glimpse into how those efforts have influenced their personal spirituality and ministry. Rabbi Karf is Rabbi Emeritus at Congregation Beth Israel. Reverend Lawson is the founding pastor of Wheeler Avenue Baptist Church, and Archbishop Fiorenza is Archbishop Emeritus of Galveston, Houston. The Rothko